Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, please press the star, then one, and please record your name. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to introduce your speakers, Dr. Lyle Peterson, Director of CDC's Division of Vector-Borne Diseases, and Dr. Cynthia Moore, Director of CDC's Division of Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. Dr. Peterson will first give opening remarks, and he and Dr. Moore will be available for questions. Thank you, and you may begin.
Hey, Kathy, this is Tom Skinner. I apologize. I think you had a wrong script for this, but we're joined today. That's okay. We're joined today by Dr. Anne Schuchat, who's the Principal Deputy Director of the CDC, and Dr. Tony Fauci, who is the Director of the National Institutes for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Both are going to provide some opening remarks about the current outbreak of Zika virus infection. We understand we're getting a lot of calls, and there's a lot of interest in this story right now, and we want to try to provide you all with as much information as we can. And so we're having this telebriefing, and so I'll turn the call now over to Dr. Schuchat.
Thanks so much, Tom, and thank you, everybody, for calling in for today's telebrief. Today, Dr. Fauci and I will talk about what we know about Zika virus, what we don't know, and what we're working hard to find out about. We know many people are concerned or scared, and we want to answer your questions with what we do know now. Zika is not a new virus, but what we're seeing in the Americas right now is new. Zika was first recognized in 1947, and it caused occasional illness in Africa and Asia, but the first outbreak we know of occurred in 2007 in the small Pacific island of Yap. But last May, the first local transmission of Zika in the Americas was reported by WHO from Brazil. And by the end of the year, Brazilian authorities were estimating that perhaps a million suspected cases of Zika had occurred there. Substantial illness seems to have been occurring last spring, and by this fall, Brazil authorities recognized a concerning increase in the usually rare serious condition among newborns, microcephaly. Consistent with the idea that some of the mothers of these babies had been infected with the virus early in their pregnancy, potentially harming their developing baby. Zika is a mosquito-borne virus and usually causes very mild illness. Unlike another flavivirus, dengue, which can cause life-threatening disease or extremely painful symptoms. About 4 of 5 people who get infected with Zika never have symptoms at all. Those who do get sick usually have very mild symptoms, fever, rash, joint pain, and red eyes or conjunctivitis. The symptoms typically last a couple days up to a week. It's very rare for a person with Zika to get seriously ill or to die. But increasing lines of evidence suggest that some women who are infected with Zika during their pregnancy may go on to deliver a baby with a serious brain injury. Here is what we know. Brazilian health authorities initially reported more than 3,500 cases of microcephaly, a serious birth defect, in the past year, following the major Zika virus outbreak that they experienced. Laboratory tests at CDC strongly suggest a link between Zika infection and some of these poor pregnancy outcomes. Brazil is continuing to verify their findings on this birth defect. We don't yet know what other outcomes might be associated with Zika infection during pregnancy, and there may be other factors in addition to Zika infection that might have increased risk to the fetus. More lab testing and other studies are in progress to learn more about the results, about the risks of Zika virus infection during pregnancy. We understand that this condition is devastating to the affected families and that this ongoing outbreak is concerning to everyone, especially for pregnant women and their families who may travel or live in the affected areas. Zika virus spread in the Americas and its effect on pregnancies are new developments that we are working with partners to better understand. Health authorities in Brazil have also reported an increase in Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare neurologic disorder in which a person's own immune system damages nerve cells, leading to muscle weakness and sometimes paralysis. These symptoms can last a few weeks or several months. Most people fully recover, but it can take a few years to do so. CDC is currently working with public health officials in Brazil to investigate whether there's any link between Zika infection and Guillain-Barré. Next, I want to turn to the epidemiologic situation. Zika cases are now confirmed in more than 20 countries within South and Central America, and we've also seen a limited number of cases in the two U.S. territories, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The virus is spreading throughout the Americas, and we expect more countries to be affected. All of the continental U.S. cases to date have been in people who have traveled to a country where mosquitoes carrying the Zika virus are circulating. We have not yet seen local transmission of Zika in the continental U.S. And by local transmission, we mean that a mosquito bites a person who's infected with Zika, and then that mosquito passes the infection on to another person through a mosquito bite. Zika is spread to people by the Aedes mosquito. These types of mosquitoes are common in parts of the United States, particularly southern states. So it's possible, even likely, that we will see limited Zika outbreaks in the U.S. The same kind of mosquito has caused limited U.S. outbreaks of dengue and chikungunya virus, but there have been no widespread outbreaks or epidemics in the continental U.S. as a result. Other factors also may work in our favor here. Our urban areas aren't as densely populated as affected areas in Central and South America, and we have widespread use of air conditioning and stronger mosquito control. That experience with dengue and chikungunya and the different living conditions lead us to believe that any outbreaks of Zika in the continental U.S. will likely be limited. Of course, this virus is fairly new to the Americas, and we will remain vigilant. CDC experts are working intensively to learn more about this outbreak and help people have the information they need to protect themselves. We've issued travel alerts for the affected areas as confirmation of the virus comes in, and we will keep you alert as the situation changes. We've provided guidance for doctors and other clinicians on pregnant women and infants, including through our MMWR and additional clinician outreach efforts. Labs here at CDC are helping state health labs with diagnostic testing and have provided training and materials for labs in Brazil and throughout the Latin American region. We've added Zika to our list of notifiable conditions, so state health departments are required to report cases to CDC so we can track and respond to the spread of this illness. And we have a team on the ground in Brazil and are working with other international partners to learn more about this outbreak. We have two research partnerships on. One is already underway, and one is going to be starting soon. So we're doing a lot. But I do need to tell you that community mosquito control may be difficult. The current methods that we have some shortcomings, and we're going to need to work in the future on identifying better options. However, for the general public, we want to make sure you know what you can do to protect yourself. If you are pregnant, we recommend you consider postponing travel to a region with ongoing Zika virus transmission. If you must travel to or you live in an affected area, talk to your doctor and strictly follow steps to prevent mosquito bites if you're pregnant. You can find more information on affected areas and on how to protect yourself on the CDC website. Reducing exposure to mosquitoes for anyone in areas where the virus is circulating is important. Wearing long sleeves and long pants, using insect repellent like DEET, which we think is safe to use in pregnancy, and other protection like screens and air conditioning to reduce exposure to these daytime mosquitoes. It's important to remember that this is a rapidly changing situation. As we get new information, we may need to update our advice. At this stage in a relatively new health threat, information evolves quickly, and we expect that the situation will continue to change as we learn more. We're working very closely with colleagues in the affected areas as well as here at home to get the answers that people need. And as we learn more about this virus and its health effects, we will share what we know so you have the information you need to protect yourself and your family. Now I want to turn things over to Dr. Fauci.
Thank you very much, Anne. Good morning, and thank you all for joining us today. I'm going to briefly address the research efforts that are underway at the National Institutes of Health to combat Zika outbreak and its consequences. The NIH is working with partners in government, academia, and industry to accelerate research in areas ranging from natural history of the disease, basic research on the virus itself, disease pathogenesis, diagnostics, vaccines, and therapeutics. Within NIH, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases has long supported research on flaviviruses and other arboviruses, namely those viruses that are spread by mosquitoes, ticks, and other arthropods. The category includes dengue, West Nile, and chikungunya, all of which have emerged in the Western Hemisphere within the past few decades. With the emergence of Zika virus, we are focusing our efforts on several fronts, including the development of animal models to understand the impact of this virus on the body, especially in pregnancy. We are also supporting, along with the CDC, the development of diagnostic platforms that can rapidly determine if a patient is infected with Zika or has been infected either recently or in the past, and distinguish it from other flaviviruses, particularly dengue infection. Such diagnostic tools will be critical to reassure the uninfected pregnant women in areas where Zika is occurring and pregnant women returning from such areas. At the same time, NIAID researchers are working on vaccine candidates to prevent Zika virus infection. It is to our advantage that we already have existing vaccine platforms to use as a sort of jumping-off point. NIAID is currently pursuing at least two approaches to a Zika vaccine. First, a DNA-based vaccine using a strategy very similar to what we employed for another flavivirus, the West Nile virus, as this vaccine was found in a phase one trial to be both safe and immunogenic. Second, a live attenuated vaccine building on similar and highly immunogenic approaches used for the closely related dengue virus. While these approaches are promising, it is important to understand that we will not have a widely available, safe and effective Zika vaccine this year and probably not even in the next few years, although we may be able to begin an early phase one clinical trial actually within this calendar year. We need to look at Zika virus in its context as the latest in a series of mosquito-borne diseases that have expanded their reach in the past 20 years or so. These include, as you heard, dengue, West Nile virus, and chikungunya just last year. There will almost certainly be others. We need vaccine platforms that can be quickly modified for protection against emerging new threats, and we need broad-spectrum antiviral drugs effective against whole classes of viruses. This has been and will continue to be an important area of emphasis for NIAID. In the meantime, we have issued a call to the research community to highlight our interest in funding a number of vital areas of research that are specific to the current threat of Zika. In addition to accelerated research towards diagnostics, treatments, and vaccines, which I've already briefly discussed, we're calling for basic research to understand Zika virus infection, its replication, its pathogenesis, and its transmission. We will be developing animal models. We're doing studies on the evolution and emergence of the virus, including the identification of factors that affect host range and virulence. Surveillance studies of the distribution and natural history in collaboration with the CDC will be done. Basic research on the biology of the mosquito vectors, their competence studies for replication and transmission, and host-virus interactions, as well as studies on novel vector control mechanisms. Also, evaluation of the immune response, both to infection and to vaccination, as well as evaluating the relative immune responses to Zika, as well as other flaviviruses, particularly dengue, and to some extent yellow fever, and in addition, the interaction of these responses and the impact on the disease itself. And so clearly there are very many important areas of scientific inquiry, and we at NIH are in constant communication with government, academia, and industry partners, both within the United States and internationally, including our long-term collaborators in Brazil and other South American countries. NIH is actively pursuing answers to the numerous scientific questions related to Zika infection, and we're sharing this information in real time, refining our scientific priorities, and developing new avenues for accelerating research. Such findings from these endeavors will inform the global public health response. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I would be very pleased to answer your questions. Thank you.
Okay, Kathy, I believe that we're ready for questions, please.
All right, thank you. At this time, we're ready to begin a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star one and please record your name. We are taking questions only from the media at this time, and one question with one follow-up. Again, press star one if you have a question. And our first question comes from Mike Strobe of the Associated Press.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First, Dr. Fauci, you just talked about a call to the research community to highlight your interest. Could you tell me how much money NIH is going to be devoting to this and how much of it, what you've been spending previously on Zika research? And then I have a follow-up for Dr. Shuket.
Okay, that's a good question. And as you heard, as Dr. Shuket said, this is a brand new virus. So we, prior to this time, have really not spent anything on Zika. However, we do have a substantial resource commitment to the flavivirus class. So we spend about $97 million on flavivirus research. And when you ask how much we're going to spend, it really depends on the kinds of requests that come in and the kinds of projects that we're going to be pursuing. So I can't put a number on it except to say that we will be utilizing the grantees and the grants that are already out there for flavivirus and immediately supplementing them. I imagine that this is going to require a considerable amount of resources, but right now we're just going to fund what comes in with the money we have, and if additional money comes in, then we will, I'm sure, utilize it very well. But we want the community to get actively involved, both with new ideas as well as tacking on to some of the other things we're doing with flavivirus. One of the things I'll point out that we've actually already started here in our intramural program with our vaccine research center, the center that was involved in the development of the Ebola vaccine, as well as West Nile and other vaccines, that we're using the same platforms that we used to develop a West Nile to already get started on making material that we will get into GMP grade to be able to start reasonably soon, at least within this year, on a phase one trial. So things are moving rapidly.
Okay. Thank you. And Dr. Shuket, could you just go over the latest numbers for the U.S.? How many cases in residents of the 50 states, were they all travel-related? Were any of them women? How many of them gave, any of them pregnant women? How many of those? How many gave birth? And also for the territories numbers, I guess Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, how many in each of those, and how many of those were believed to have been transmitted there versus acquired through travel?
Thanks so much, Mike. The statistics for the U.S., first let me talk about the travel-associated cases. There are 31 travel-associated cases that have been detected in 11 states and the District of Columbia. That is for the period from 2015 to the present. And for the U.S. territories, there are 20 laboratory-confirmed cases that we are aware of, 19 from Puerto Rico, and one from the U.S. Virgin Islands. I think for the pregnancy numbers, we could get back with you later. But that is based on what's come in. I would say that the issue of us making this nationally notifiable and the accessibility for laboratory testing for the lab confirmation with the PCR is just increasing. So we really do expect there to be a lot more travel-associated cases. The key thing for people to know and remember is that most of these are very mild illnesses. It's really the circumstances of pregnant women who are traveling that we want to have heightened awareness of, and we really caution pregnant women to consider postponing travel. We hope to know more and be able to give more guidance in the future, but that's our best recommendation right now. So again, the issue for Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands is that those that includes individuals who are laboratory confirmed. They may be locally acquired or have traveled, but that's what's been detected in those two places, in those two territories.
Next question, Kathy.
All right, the next question comes from Helen Branswell at Stat News.
Thank you very much for taking my question. It's for Dr. Shukat, and before I ask it, I would say that if you come up with numbers of U.S. cases that involve pregnant women, I would also be interested in getting those numbers. Dr. Shukat, earlier the CDC did some pretty important work on samples from Brazil, finding Zika virus in the brains of two babies that had been born with microcephaly and died shortly after birth, and also in placenta tissues from women who had miscarried fetuses that had microcephaly. Are you testing additional samples from Brazil or elsewhere? Or have you found additional evidence?
Thank you, Helen. This is a really important issue, and what I can say is that we're working very closely with Brazil and other affected countries, that we just had folks down in the area doing laboratory training so that better access to testing could be done close to where the action is, and we're working closely with the state health departments on laboratory testing. We did, you know, that initial MMWR when we had the CDC confirmatory lab findings. We thought that was very important information for the public to know about and are continuing to look at this. Now, a number of the studies in Brazil are going to be looking at children with birth defects who were born quite a while ago, and so laboratory testing will be challenging in those kind of circumstances. But I would just say this is a very active effort right now, and there's including prospective studies where we'll have a better chance of being able to recognize the laboratory component of these conditions.
Helen, do you have a follow-up?
I guess I would just ask, are you saying that you currently don't have any additional cases that you could speak about in terms of finding virus that would support this, in places that would support this theory?
Yeah, I think we've reported what we're able to report right now, but we can check back to see if there's additional ones that are confirmed and able to be reported. I don't think we're going to be surprised, given the number of clinical episodes there have been and the extent of spread in the Americas, for there to be additional lab-confirmed cases among pregnant women. I think what we're really focusing in on now is more detailed research in understanding the factors that lead to an increased risk of these conditions and really careful review of the clinical circumstances. Microcephaly is a complex condition, and the surveillance or detection of it is not that simple. So as you know, the Brazilians are reviewing their records quite carefully, and we're working closely with partners in other areas as well. So I think putting together this clinical outcome that's of such great concern and the laboratory findings is going to be a work in progress in the days and weeks ahead.
Next question, Kathy.
Our next question comes from Betsy McKay, Wall Street Journal.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. One is for Dr. Fauci. You mentioned a phase one clinical trial that may start later this year. Could you clarify which vaccine approach that would be, which one of the vaccine approaches that you mentioned that would be? I thought you said West Nile, but I wasn't sure. And then the second question for Dr. Shukat or for Dr. Fauci, I wanted to follow up on what Helen was asking about, you know, what's known about the disease in pregnant women. Is there any way to know if, or is there any, do you have any findings showing whether pregnant women who are infected but don't get sick are at risk for their babies? Is there any way to know that at this point? A risk of microcephaly, sorry.
So let me answer your first question, Betsy, and then we'll hand it over to Ann. So I was referring to the DNA construct in which we inserted a West Nile viral gene insert. That construct, when put into cells, makes virus-like particles. And that is a study that was done with West Nile and ultimately published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases in 2011. The first author was Julie Ledgerwood, and the study said a West Nile virus DNA vaccine utilizing a modified promoter induces neutralizing antibody in younger and older healthy adults in a phase one clinical trial. So since they're both flaviviruses and we can insert the NECA gene insert, we feel that we can get this construct reasonably soon ready to make enough to start going through the usual tox studies as well as getting into a phase one trial within the time frame that I mentioned. So there is a precedent for that. Now, the reason why the West Nile virus phase one, which were good results of safety and immunogenicity, did not really eventuate into a vaccine that was approved and produced and made widely available is that we could not find pharmaceutical partners to partner with us to push it to the next stage of advanced development. I do not anticipate that we will have any problem partnering with pharmaceutical companies now because of the extraordinary attention and interest that has now been put into Zika, and we're already talking to a few companies to be able to partner with us in advanced development.
Do you have a follow-up?
Or I think it was about the pregnancy.
Yes.
Thanks. Let me speak to that. The question was whether women who are infected with Zika virus without symptoms could have a baby with one of these birth defects. First thing to say is that we don't know for sure. We're working hard to find out. I would like to say that it's possible and that there are other viral conditions that can do that. And so that's why we're taking this very seriously, and we know that's a difficult thing for women to hear. It's one of the reasons that we've urged women who are pregnant to consider postponing travel to these affected areas as we learn more. So it is a possibility, but we don't have the strong evidence of how often that would happen or what the risk actually is.
Next question, Kathy.
The next question comes from Lisa Schnering at SIDRAP News.
Hey, thanks for the availability today. I'm wondering if anyone knows if you get infected with Zika, if that confers protection against possible infections in the future. And my second question is, during the WHO executive board briefing today, they mentioned a meeting in Washington to set research priorities, and I was wondering if that's something the U.S. government is involved in, or maybe it's not. Thanks so much.
Sure, I can begin. Based on what we know now, we do think that an infection with Zika virus will confer immunity. We don't actually know how long that'll last for. This is a fairly new virus in terms of what we understand of it, and we try to keep an open mind. We also know that the tests for Zika are not as great as we would like them to be in terms of availability or specificity, and so making sure that the immunity is to Zika and not to something else takes additional testing. So based on what we know about the infection and immunity right now, we think it's likely that one is getting long-term protection, but we just don't know how long it is, and we caution everything with a new condition like this, saying that we're keeping an open mind.
Thanks.
Dr. Fauci, do you want to address the question about WHO and research priorities?
Yeah, there are a number of meetings that will be taking place over the next couple of months as we get into the February, the beginning of March. Meetings from international collaborators getting together trying to get and compare the research agendas and trying to synergize on Zika research. And that's going to be happening. You're going to be hearing more of it. You know, we have our own groups here within the department in which we look at our research agenda with the CDC, the FDA, and other components of HHS, but also meeting within the U.S. government. But the U.S. government will be participating in those international workshops that are going to be looking at a broad international research agenda. So the answer to the question is yes, we know about it, and we will be participating.
Next question, Kathy.
All right, our next question comes from Sabrina Tavernisi in New York Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I'm trying to piece together, ask Tom a bit about this. The Brazilians last night had some sort of confusing numbers. They gave our reporter in Brazil the following numbers, that only like 6 or 7 of the about 700 microcephaly cases that they had analyzed had actually had Zika or been exposed to Zika. Is there some way you guys could explain that, or is that just sort of a confusion? I mean, it sort of leads one to the conclusion that actually there's very little association between Zika and microcephaly.
You know, thank you for that question. What I can say is that at this point in an ongoing investigation, information is being gathered, and so the Brazilians would be the best source of exactly what information they have right now. Remember that they are piecing together review of episodes that occurred quite a while ago. They're collecting specimens from those they can find. They may or may not have tested large numbers. So I think it's very premature for us to try to help decipher that. I would say that there are many ways to study this kind of issue and try to clarify how strong a risk factor a Zika virus infection would be for a pregnancy complication. And so both the experience the Brazilians have had and then prospective studies will be very important. CDC is working closely with Brazil and other countries, and the real sort of the community that works on birth defects day in and day out to try to really understand this. It's a very difficult issue, really important, and I think we're going to have some somewhat challenging information coming out over the weeks ahead until we can really clarify the situation. So I'm sorry that I can't tease it out for you.
That's okay. Can I ask one follow-up? Could you, Dr. Fauci or Dr. Shuchat, speak directly to what the risk actually is for Americans in the United States? I mean, everybody's saying, oh, there are mosquitoes everywhere, and then people are saying, oh, but we have air conditioners and we have window screens, and actually the risk is very low. I mean, can you just sort of break it down into simple English?
Yes, Sabrina, are you referring to the risk now, for example, with mosquitoes? As Ann said, and she should chime in, we don't have local transmission of the virus in the United States right now. So we are getting questions that are understandable, that people are nervous, are saying, well, you know, I live in this place right now and I got bit by a bunch of mosquitoes.
Right, exactly. What do you say to that person?
You say that there's really essentially no risk at all because we don't have locally transmitted Zika virus in the United States. I mean, that's an understandable concern when they read about this massive outbreak in South America and the Caribbean. And that's the reason why Ann and I, when we talk about this over the last weeks or so, when we talk about make sure we distinguish between a local transmission within a country and a traveler that just comes back and happens to have Zika infection. There's a big difference there.
Yeah, and what's the factors that are stopping the local transmission?
Yeah, maybe I can share a little bit about that. You know, we have the mosquito that can carry this virus in many parts of the United States, and we have seen local transmission of other mosquito-borne conditions in a couple areas in the southern United States, but we haven't seen large outbreaks. And the factors that go into that include the very dense urban areas in South America or Central America where some of these outbreaks have been described, the living conditions where we have most people with access to air conditioning or screens versus a much more outdoor open air lifestyle, and then that density of population where it makes it easy for mosquitoes to hop around between people. The level of mosquitoes is more intense in some of these areas where mosquito control is not as strong as it is here, and so we do expect that we are at risk for local transmission, and I think we're not going to be surprised to report that. I don't want to give a misconception here that we're not expecting there to be some local transmission. But based on the experience with the other mosquito-borne viruses and those areas in the southern United States, we aren't expecting really big, difficult-to-control ones. That said, we're going to jump on this if we find local transmission and work closely with the local authorities to better control the problem. For the average American who's not traveling, this is not something they need to worry about. For people who are pregnant and considering travel to the affected areas, please take this seriously. It's very important that you understand that we don't know as much as we want to know about this yet. And while we're learning more, it's prudent to consider postponing travel. And if you must travel, please talk to one healthcare provider and protect yourself from mosquito bites.
Next question, Kathy.
All right, next question is from Liz Zabel from USA Today.
Hi, Dr. Shuckett. You had mentioned that mosquito control could be difficult in the United States, and I was hoping you could elaborate on that.
Yes, you know, we've done well in terms of some of the insect-borne diseases in the U.S., but controlling mosquitoes, this type of mosquitoes, is somewhat difficult. The current options have limited efficacy. They include elimination of breeding sites, larvicidal treatment, and outdoor spraying to kill the adult mosquitoes. These are pretty aggressive daytime biters, and so you don't need huge amounts of mosquitoes to be able to have a mosquito infect a person, and it's really hard to just knock them out totally. So I think our researchers feel that better vector control is a real important area to invest in terms of research and strategies. You know, there's some innovative approaches that are being looked at, both different products, different attempts to do better vector mapping and ecologic studies and risk assessment to really hone in on where the transmission's occurring and aggressively intervene. There's work on some simple and inexpensive methods to monitor insecticide resistance and improve methods to minimize the development of resistance. We think that large-scale intervention trials are going to be needed to understand the effectiveness of different approaches. But, you know, it's easy to say get rid of the mosquitoes. It's a lot harder to do it.
Okay, thanks. What about the prospect that some have mentioned about releasing genetically engineered sterile mosquitoes?
Yes, the idea of the genetically engineered mosquitoes is very intriguing. At this point, that's unproven on a large scale, but I think it's a really exciting idea and important to understand community acceptance and how to take on the research question in a larger scale way. So we're gratified that individuals are looking into these innovative approaches, and we really encourage more of that because I think the mosquitoes are probably going to outlive us, and it would be good for us to find some better methods.
Okay, thanks.
Next question, Kathy.
All right. Our next question is from Eben Brown, Fox News.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for doing this. These questions, two of them for either doctor that wishes to answer. First, we've been talking about mosquito control. Here, I'm calling from South Florida. Mosquito control is a bit of a political situation, meaning that we have elected officials who deal specifically with mosquito control. We have mosquito control boards. What should towns really be thinking about doing? Second question, there was an article, I think, within the past week suggesting that there was a case of sexually transmitted Zika virus between a husband and a wife. Husband had traveled, may have gotten sick. Wife, who did not travel, became sick. It was revealed that they were intimate upon his return. Could you comment on that, please? And is that really something we ought to be worried about, or is it too soon to tell?
Thanks for those questions. And let me take them in reverse order. There is one reported case of Zika virus through possible sexual transmission. In another case, Zika virus was found in semen about 2 weeks after a man had symptoms with Zika virus infection. So that sort of gives you the biologic plausibility of spread. But the science is very clear to date that Zika virus is primarily transmitted to people through the bite of an infected mosquito. I don't know if an inspected mosquito can transmit, but an infected mosquito can transmit. And so that's really where we're putting the emphasis right now. In terms of the local mosquito control issues, those are difficult issues. I think that communities need to understand the what's known about the science, what's known about benefits and risks, and work together with their authorities to understand what's going to be acceptable. I do think that there's a lot of innovation that we're excited about understanding, and we know that the Brazilians are very interested in exploring more effective approaches. But I think in terms of your local Florida situation, you know, the community discussions are going to be important to continue.
Great, thank
you. Next question.
Next question is from Caleb Hillerman, PBS NewsHour.
Hi, thank you. I'm just following up on the question of how many cases you're sort of expecting to see. I mean, obviously, now that this is reportable, you're going to be getting many more calls. Also, just based on the range and the behavior of this mosquito in the Americas, and obviously we're going to be heading into warm weather, what do we know about the seasonality of the other related infections, and when we might start to see large spikes in cases, and just how do you think people should view the numbers that inevitably are going to be starting to look big?
Right. We do expect, you know, we do believe that the virus is widespread in South America, and that we will have travelers infected with it coming back and detected, and part of that will just be about how many of them present to get tested. So there is some experience from the chikungunya virus, which was a relatively new virus to the Americas and did occur among travelers, and we actually got large numbers of reported travelers. But in terms of that local transmission, it was minuscule, you know, a handful of local transmission, whether it's been the chikungunya or the dengue virus. So I think we need to be prepared to have numbers of cases among travelers go up quite a bit, but we don't think that's a concern for the average American. We think that's just going to be a sign of a good surveillance system. What we really think is important is that pregnant women consider postponing travel to affected areas, and that in these areas where the mosquito can circulate, like South Florida, that we have very active surveillance and detect the conditions quickly so that we can intervene as effectively as possible. So I think that, you know, we have a certain amount of comfort because we've been through the chikungunya experience and the dengue experience, but we also know this is a new virus to us, and we have to keep an open mind.
So let me just add one brief comment to that, because I've gotten asked a lot of questions about this. First of all, we always say, as Ann has reiterated a few times, and I totally agree, that a lot we don't know, so we have to be very careful in making absolute predictions. We still feel, based on prior experience, that, as Ann said, and I agree, it is unlikely we're going to see widespread outbreaks, and we likely will see some local transmission. So first of all, for the press, be prepared for that. If that happens, that's not going to be an unexpected phenomenon to see a little cluster, very likely in the southeastern part of the country along the Gulf Coast and Florida, the way we saw it with dengue and with chikungunya. But the other thing that's important is that you see in several newspaper articles, they show the map of distribution of the Aedes aegypti, which is in the southeastern part of the country, and then a much greater distribution of the Aedes albopictus, which is another mosquito that may or may not be able to efficiently transmit. That we don't really know yet. It's mostly Aedes aegypti. Don't make the assumption then that you're going to see outbreak in that distribution of mosquitoes. That's just where the mosquitoes are. We're being prepared, and we're not going to be cavalier about it, for there being that kind of spread, but that is highly unlikely, as we've said multiple times. Be prepared for it, but that's not something that we expect to see based on the experience with dengue and chikungunya.
And I think you also asked about the seasonality, and, you know, based on the situation with dengue virus and chikungunya virus in South America, the seasonality can actually vary by country, and year to year we can see big differences in, you know, how bad a dengue year it is or not. So I think, again, with this being relatively new to the Americas, we'll be very interested in understanding seasonality and that'll be important information for travelers to learn about, but we don't have that yet for this virus.
Next question, Kathy.
Next question comes from Lorna Benson of Minnesota Public Radio.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if there is any risk to the blood supply regarding blood donations. And then secondly, I wonder if there is a difference in risk depending on for pregnant women, depending on what trimester they're in. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. The blood supply is of great interest, and I think I want to say that the FDA is looking at the issue of blood supply, blood donors, and travelers. One thing that we know about Zika virus is that it's in the bloodstream very briefly. It's not, as far as we know, there for a long time, so that most people have cleared their bloodstream of the virus by about a week. So we think this is an issue that the FDA will be deliberating about in terms of blood donors. The second question you had was about the trimesters. And, of course, as almost every question about pregnancy and Zika virus is one that we're keenly interested in having better answers for, we do believe that the injury of microcephaly is usually one that begins in the first trimester, but we don't believe we have sufficient knowledge now to know what, if any, effects infection in the second or third trimester would have. We know that there are other viruses, like rubella, which can cause birth defects, a number of problems, including, hearing loss and vision loss, as well as heart defects and even major brain damage, and that there are different effects at different times during pregnancy. So we really feel for the women that are pregnant living in these endemic areas and know that this is a challenging time for them, and our scientists are working closely with counterparts to understand better.
Thank you.
Kathy, I know we still have possibly a lot of questions or reporters in queue, so let's go to the next question. We'll go for about 10 more minutes. Next question, please.
All right. The next question is from Richard Knox, WBUR Boston.
Hi, thanks very much. A couple of things. One having to do with Puerto Rico, which, as we know, has got enormous financial problems right now. I don't know whether that is going to interfere with their ability to respond to this, and particularly with mosquito abatement. But I wonder from the CDC what is happening with regard to assisting Puerto Rico being the challenge and what needs to happen.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, one of the CDC installations, our dengue branch, is based in Puerto Rico. I think we have about 40 or so staff based there working very closely with the Puerto Rican health authorities and laboratory experts. And so we are very, very closely linked in with the Puerto Rican health experts and the community, and are working closely to assure that surveillance is ongoing and to get information to the community. There's enormous experience in Puerto Rico from their dengue research and surveillance efforts, and building on that is exactly the right thing to do for the community there. They have good surveillance, they have great lab testing, they have good communication expertise, and an ability, we hope, to really recognize how widespread this is and what interventions will be most effective. So I think this is a huge priority for us at the CDC and across the government. You know, these are Americans in Puerto Rico, and we're committed to be working closely to protect their health.
Thank you. I just wondered, do you have any worry about the ability to mount widespread abatement, mosquito abatement possibilities? I did have another question about albopictus, if I may.
Yes, as I mentioned before, mosquito control is very difficult, and we are very keen to learn what works in this context, to try to identify the areas where the major transmission or the major breeding grounds are. We know that the mosquito control is just one of the many interventions. We think it's really important for people to protect themselves, because we might not be as successful in controlling the mosquito as we'd like. And again, that means long pants, long sleeves. You can be using the permethrin-treated clothing, wearing DEET or similar effective repellent. which is safe in pregnancy, safe for children up over 2 months of age, and for babies under 2 months of age, there are ways to protect them through nets and so forth in terms of their baby carriage and their bed and all that. We think it's really, really important for us to be working closely in Puerto Rico with the community, and that the mosquito control, while very important, isn't the only thing that we have to offer.
Okay, next question, please.
Next question is from Dan Child, ABC News.
Thank you very much for taking my question. The first question I had was for Dr. Shuket, and it was a short one. Do we happen to know the case counts in travel-associated Zika in each state? Because you had mentioned 11 states and D.C. And then also, for women who aren't pregnant, but perhaps plan to be later on down the line, do we know enough yet to say that the link to microcephaly has only been seen in cases when the infection is still active? Or is there any hint that this associated risk might linger for longer than the symptoms do?
Okay, thank you. We haven't yet released the state-by-state counts. I think that's one of the things we'll expect to be doing at some regularity, so stay tuned for that. You know, as I mentioned before, we're expecting a lot of travel-associated cases, and so we know the numbers are real important to people, but they may not be that critical. But we will be working with our state colleagues to get that information out on a regular basis, but probably not on a daily basis. Then the other question was about how long the infection might be active in a woman and harming, potentially causing harm for her baby. We believe this is a time-limited infection in women and men and children, that people have symptoms for up to about a week, and so we don't think this is one where you're having, you know, months or years of chronic viral infection that could cause harm to the baby. So, but we know that 4 out of 5 people with this infection, we believe, have no symptoms. So it's a little bit complicated to know, well, when did it start, when did it stop? Our scientists are working closely with counterparts on some investigations that might help us understand this in a more rigorous way. But based on what we know right now, we think it's that active period of infection, which may or may not have symptoms, and is pretty short time.
Kathy, we have about 5 more minutes, so let's go to the next question, please.
Next question is from John Larriman of Bloomberg News.
Hi. So what is the state of the research right now to establish the connection between these birth defects and Zika virus? How is that being pursued?
Sure. Let me give you kind of a general outline. You know, the first thing that's very important is very careful clinical review of the information on the babies that have been recognized with birth defects. Microcephaly itself has some looseness around what it is, and you want to make sure that the infant really has that condition. But there are many other birth defects that can be present in a child. So we think that the pediatricians, the geneticists, the developmental experts in Brazil and elsewhere, including CDC, will be really carefully reviewing the records. There's also plans to prospectively be following a cohort of pregnant women to really understand, do they get infected or not with the virus, and what happens over time during the pregnancy, and then what happens with the babies. And that's a kind of study that's quite intensive, large scale, to detect a rare problem, and will obviously be a major collaboration. So that work is not yet begun, but discussions are very active about that, because I think the field believes that's very important. There's also a collaboration between Brazil and CDC and possibly others around using a case control design to compare babies with the microcephaly condition and other babies born at around the same time in around the same area to look in more depth at different factors that the mothers were exposed to, and to look at laboratory tests from the mothers and babies and really get a better idea of what proportion, if any, of these birth defects can be specifically linked with the Zika virus. So I think there's a host of things that are being looked at, but those are a couple of the ones that are high on the list.
Thank you.
Next question, Kathy?
The next question is from Sandy Lamont of CNN.
Thank you very much for taking my question. Do you have the exact listing of the states that you're saying that are the 11 so that we can use that for maps? And
yes, Sandy, this is Tom. We hope to be providing that information to you soon when we get things synced up through ArboNet, but we'll be providing that hopefully to you soon. Do you have another question?
I do, and that had to do with the specific areas that were that you look at for historical, looking with chikungunya and dengue here in the United States. What specific areas in the United States did that include?
Yeah, I think those are the southern tips of Florida and Texas and perhaps other similar tips of the South. I'm trying to recall if California's on that list. Not on that list. Okay. So, you know, there's been a little, you know, and again, those are small, very small local transmission.
It's the Florida Keys and Dade County with the dengue. In the 2012, there was a small cluster that was taken care of by vector control, but it was in the Florida Keys and then some cases in Dade County.
Thank you.
Kathy, we'll take one last question, please.
Okay, one moment. We have a question from Nora Kelly, Atlantic.
Thank you for making yourselves available. My question is, it's my understanding that El Nino is expected to bring some heavy rains to the south over the next few months. How much of a concern is that in terms of mosquitoes breeding?
Of course, we're concerned about heavy rains for many reasons in terms of the damage that that can cause. In terms of the risks for this particular virus and spread in those southern tips of Florida and Texas, that is not a major concern. We think the critical issues are to be doing good surveillance and actively recognizing when there's local spread and to follow up pretty actively with mosquito control at that local point. So we do think the living conditions in general in the United States, the lack of urban density in those areas where the mosquito is circulating and the air conditioning and screens will hopefully keep us in better shape compared with what's going on in some of the hot spots in South America or the Caribbean.
Yeah, also an interesting question comes up when you talk about people who bring up the topic of climate change and very dry or very wet. Mosquitoes are very interesting species that sometimes changes in climate that you think might propagate them actually make it less favorable for the mosquitoes. So sometimes climate changes could make it either worse in the sense of more mosquitoes or actually even better with few mosquitoes. And it really depends on the relative extent of dryness versus wetness, which can all be consequences of extremes of climate.
All right. Kathy, I believe we're ready to conclude our briefing here. Thanks to Dr. Shukat and Dr. Fauci, and thank you to everyone for joining us this morning. We'll continue to share information with you as we have it. A transcript of this telebriefing will be posted to the CDC Newsroom website as soon as possible. We realize some of you weren't able to ask your questions, and should you have additional questions, please call the CDC press office at 404-639-3286 or email CDC. Send your email to media@cdc.gov. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This does complete today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.